Welcome to our show. This is our premiere episode, which means it's our first. And coming up on today's show, we have a bit about director Christopher Nolan, the director of films such as Memento and Batman Begins. We're going to have a trivia question from Sam. I'm going to talk a little bit about movie cliffhangers, where they've come from and maybe where they're going. We're going to do top six about romantic comedies, but they're not the sort of romantic comedies you might think of when you think of the word romantic comedy. And we're going to have a little DVD segment about some upcoming releases that are for the month of October. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard. But you know what they call me in France?
What do they call you in France?
They call me Le Sam Stoddard.
Oh, it's because of the metric system, right?
Yeah, right.
Just a little note to you all about this episode. This was our first attempt at doing a podcast, so some of the audio is a little rough. If you hear some noise blasting out of your headphones and then you don't hear a whole lot because the audio goes down a little bit, we apologize. I assure you that our future episodes sound much, much cleaner.
But it's still good stuff.
Absolutely.
So that's why we chose to keep it and air it for you in this special premiere episode.
All right, on this segment, we're going to call it Director Spotlight, and we'll just talk about a different director each time we do this. This week, we want to do Christopher Nolan. He's an interesting guy to watch. He's made only four films to date, but he's made a pretty big impression. He writes and directs them all, and he's developed a pretty distinctive and very effective style. They're all psychological thrillers and have something to observe about the human mind under duress. His first feature film went largely unnoticed until people went back to it later. It's called Following, a black and white film about a writer who is so fascinated by human behavior that he likes to follow people around, just to watch them, just to see what they do. But things pretty quickly devolve when he's confronted by one of the people he follows. And this guy turns out to be a burglar who takes him under his wing and shows him the ropes. Feels like a lot of the films you see from film school students, a quirky little thriller drama kind of thing that isn't really as clever as it thinks it is. But the difference here is that Following really is that clever. It's a pretty devious film, short and to the point, and what it has to say is sort of the quantum mechanics of human behavior. Can you observe others impartially? Probably not. You can't do it because the act of observing changes yourself and who you're observing.
One thing I'd like to mention about Following, I think, is interesting is how it plays with time. It's one story, but there are three timelines that you're watching. It keeps every time it cuts between a scene, you're jumping in time, and as the movie progresses, you start out very, very confused, and as the movie progresses, you sort of pick up the threads and figure out where each sort of thread occurs in relation to the other movies, which I think is interesting because his next movie was famous precisely for playing with time.
Right. It's Memento, probably his most famous of his first three, anyway. But in this one, I think he really smoothed out all the little minor kinks that he might have had in Following. This one feels very confident. And basically, it's a thriller about a guy who's trying to solve a murder mystery, the catch being that he has no long-term memory, so anything he discovers, he quickly forgets. He can't really remember anything at all for more than just a few minutes. Now, ingeniously, a couple of major critics actually thought this was a gimmick, but I don't think so at all. The story is told backwards from the end to the beginning. You see a scene, and then it cuts to what happened just prior to that. And what this accomplishes is it allows the audience to identify the character. He doesn't know what's just happened. We don't either.
Well, you know, one of my favorite parts about Memento, which is a movie I just really, really like, I've seen it several times, is that there's actually a thread of scenes, sort of like Following, that are shot actually in black and white and that don't occur out of order. They're actually in regular chronological order, and that thread actually meets the backwards scenes at one point, and the movie shifts from black and white into color, and it sort of happens very imperceptibly. The first time you see it, you don't really notice it, but when you watch it again, I think it's really amazing how this sort of, I mean, it should be a really obvious stylistic gimmick, but it works completely within the context of the film. And I think that's one thing that I think Nolan doesn't get enough credit for is how stylized his movies are without necessarily calling attention to themselves. The backwards thing is pretty obvious, but there's a lot of other cool tricks that he does to sort of get into his characters' heads through the way the movie looks that aren't as noticed and remarked upon.
Yeah, and although the story itself is told backwards, the emotional arc is forward for the audience. You know, you see the revelations come in the normal structure of a murder mystery, but the story's backwards. It's kind of strange how that works out.
Yeah, and it does definitely. It's one of those movies that improves quite a bit on a second viewing. I'm kind of upset because you can't actually answer all the questions the movie raises. In terms of it being a puzzle movie, it doesn't really work. But I think just sort of as a psychological examination about the effects of memories and how reliable our own perceptions are, I think it works wonderfully.
His third film, moving on, is called Insomnia. And it actually explores the same kind of territory, even though on the surface it's pretty different. It stars Al Pacino trying to solve a murder mystery in spite of the fact that he can't sleep a wink in the 24-hour daylight of Alaska in summer. I love this film. This is a chillingly effective thriller. And it's remarkable because what I remember most strongly of this film has nothing to do with the plot itself. It's just how vividly it captures Pacino's degenerating state of mind. I just remember the image of him trying to put that blanket over that stupid window with the sun shining through and trying to get some sleep. And so, again, we got a movie that gets inside somebody's head and perceives the plot all through that perspective.
Yeah. Well, the movie also has great performances by Robin Williams and Hilary Swank as the supporting characters, but I definitely think Pacino's performance is key to it. And what I think is interesting is how subdued of a Pacino we get here. I mean, Pacino, I think if directors let him, would just love to go completely over the top every chance
sure.
that he gets.
Yeah.
And Nolan does a really great job of getting a really subdued, really tired, haggard performance out of Pacino. And you're
well,
right.
He got a subdued performance out of Robin Williams, too.
Right, and I don't even know how he did that.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. I've seen on the DVD, there's an interview with, actually it's not so much an interview, it's just a discussion between Al Pacino and Christopher Nolan. And Nolan comes across as the kind of guy who's just unsure of himself, doesn't really know what he's doing, and he's deferring to Al Pacino and saying, you know, you probably knew what I was doing before I did, and things like that. But really, that's not what comes across in the film.
No,
it comes across like Nolan is the master here.
I think this movie sort of was unfairly overlooked because it wasn't Memento Part 2. It wasn't playing with time. It wasn't gimmicky at all. But it's such a really compelling psychological thriller. I think if you haven't seen it, you should go look at it. And if you have seen it and you didn't like it that much, you should go look at it again because it may – I mean, if you're expecting another Memento, you're not going to get it, but you're getting a really great thriller.
Yeah, actually – all three films we've talked about so far, I think, make a good triple feature. You know, watch them in a row, in order, to see how Nolan's style develops and what he's doing throughout the course of his work. It's interesting because it's been a long time, I think, since somebody has successfully defined a directorial career on a genre. Mm. You know, Hitchcock does it. I hate to mention it because I don't really want to draw comparisons, but, you know, the fact is a lot of people have tried to make their careers based on doing thrillers repeatedly, as Hitchcock did, and failed.
Sure.
Maybe that's just because, you know, they're trying to imitate Hitchcock, and Nolan's not. He's got his own vision going.
Absolutely. He's not another Brian De Palma at all.
Yeah. We'll talk about Brian De Palma on a later episode.
All right.
Okay. So that brings us to film number 4.
Oh,
and
boy.
It was his leap into the mainstream. It was Batman Begins. You know, when this was announced, a lot of people were just slapping their foreheads and thinking, oh, no, they're not going to do this again. It's going to be another Batman and Robin, but worse. And I was just, maybe I'm bragging by saying so, I was just thinking, you know what, this guy is perfect. Because what the first four Batman films lacked was a real sense of the psychology of the character.
Mm.
Even the Tim Burton ones that people liked a lot more than the Schumacher ones in general didn't really get inside his head. You don't know. Actually, I remember Roger Ebert's review of the first, one of them anyway. His frustration was he didn't know who Batman was.
Right.
And I was thinking, okay, here's a guy that's directed three thrillers that are all about who the main character is. You know, you don't have to have the big action set pieces and stuff like that if you can get inside the main character's head. Because if you can make vivid and real what the main character cares about, that's what you care about. You know, if he's identifying with something, you are. If he's excited about something, you're excited by that. If he's terrified, you're terrified by that. And it doesn't matter what it is.
Right.
You know, he could be a total neurotic without any fears that you can relate to. But if you relate to the character, then that feeling hits home. So, I think that's what I was expecting with Batman Begins. I think that's what happened. We finally got a Batman movie where we understand who this character is and where he's coming from.
Well, I think that's important because I think I'm a huge unabashed Batman fan, and I think that Batman is the most psychological, probably, of all the mainstream superheroes. Certainly, he doesn't have any special powers. He's just a nutcase in a cave who hangs around tall buildings at night. He's completely and totally insane. And the first four movies just, I think, missed that entirely. They were too interested. I mean, Burton was just playing around with style, and who knows what Schumacher was doing. And I don't know. I was very skeptical about this project because I didn't think the studio would actually allow a psychological Batman movie to be made.
That was a risk, yeah.
Somehow Nolan got it done, and man, I was just delighted. I've watched it a few times, and I love it more every time I see it. I think Christian Bale was not a guy I would have ever thought to cast as Batman, but boy, if he is not sort of the definitive on-screen Batman, I don't know who is.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because you never quite know when he's being serious and when he's not in the role. You know, does he get how crazy he is or not?
I never quite know.
There's some ambiguity there.
I think certainly the actor probably gets it. But yeah, he plays, I mean, it's all played totally straight. There's no campiness at all, no nods to any of that 60s nonsense. It's all done straight and very psychological. And I think by doing the Batman origin story for this movie, it worked well because then you really get into Batman's head, because we watch the transformation of Bruce Wayne from, you know, troubled teenager into crazy Batman.
Right.
And it works pretty well. One of my favorite moments I got to mention is one of the times where Batman is talking to at this time the I guess, what is he? He's a detective, right? Detective Gordon, before he becomes the commissioner. And he tries to do his trademark escape out the window without Gordon knowing where he went, and he kind of screws it up, and I think Gordon actually sees him, like, running up a fire escape, and he goes out there and he chases him on the roofs, but, you know, Batman's able to get away. And I think those little bits that are kind of funny, we get to watch Batman screw up, which is cool, and we watch him sort of learn how he becomes Batman. And I really like the voice that Bale does as the Batman. He does that. I know the other on-screen Batmans, except for perhaps Adam West, definitely try to disguise their voice. But Bale sounds like a guy who's trying to disguise his voice and not doing a great job of it, which I think is a really cool touch.
Yeah. So upcoming for Nolan, he is doing another Batman movie that the sequel hinted at the end. But in the meantime,
with Heath Ledger as the Joker, right?
Yeah.
That should be interesting. I'm like, what? Heath Ledger? But I said that about Bale, and I'm willing to give Nolan the benefit of that this time.
You just have to go with it, yeah. But in the meantime, he's got a new film coming out in October. The trailer is available on trailers.apple.com. It's called The Prestige, and it goes into limited release on October 20th. I'm not sure when it goes wide. But anyway, it stars Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale as a couple of feuding magicians. And in the co-star list, it's pretty impressive. Michael Caine, Scarlett Johansson, David Bowie, and Andy Serkis. You know, so it's a pretty intriguing mix. Steven, I thought that the trailer was fantastic.
I've watched it like six times.
I mean, trailers are deceptive sometimes, but knowing where Nolan is coming from in general and seeing what this footage is, I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, I think there's another, I don't know why Hollywood always ends up doing movies in pairs. There's another magicians in, I think, the 18th or the 19th century movie out right now called The Illusionist, which I have absolutely no interest in. But this is going to be, I'm going to make my prediction here, this is going to be the dueling magicians in 19th century England movie to see. If you only see one of them this year, you're going to check out The Prestige. Because it looks really slick, really stylish, and Nolan's yet to make a bad movie in my book, and I'm really excited about this.
And it seems like the kind of material that would give him more of that mental, psychological stuff to work with. What's real, what's not? You know, what does the character think is real and what's not?
Well, I mean, it's a movie that's all about illusion.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that works pretty well for Nolan. I mean, the last time he really tackled the memory issue with Memento, it worked out really well, the sort of what's real, how do my perceptions relate to actual reality? I can't wait. And the trailer, as a trailer, I think is a real work of art. The way it sort of sets up what the title means and tells you a little bit about magic gives you a good sense, I'm hoping, of what the movie is going to be.
You know, in the middle of the trailer, Michael Caine has a monologue there about what the three parts of a magic trick are. And the first time I thought, wow, this is really neat. It's really digging in. Second time I watched the trailer, I'm thinking, wait a minute, he's not really saying anything.
Well, that's okay because it's cool.
It's all consistent with what this is all about, though. I think.
But here's how I know it's going to be a good movie is because Ricky Jay, one of my favorite magicians, is in it. And if you've seen any David Mamet movies, I'm sure you'll remember Ricky Jay. He's sort of this big guy who does sleight of hand and has a really cool voice. He was the narrator in Magnolias. He's an actual magician who's also a real scholar of magical history. So his involvement with this movie, I think. It says to me, hopefully, it will have some more credibility.
Yeah, that settles it. It's going to be good.
Well, I mean, Ricky Jay, he's the man.
Okay, so we're going to try to do a trivia question for you guys every week. What I'll do is I'll ask it up front now, and we'll give you the answer toward the end of the show, see if you can figure out what it is before we get there. At any rate, today's question is going to be about a film series. There's a series of films, and I'm going to describe it and see if you can identify what it is.
And, well, actually, just so you guys know, I don't actually know the question or the answer in advance, so I'm playing along with y'all.
The first episode of the series featured, in a very small role, Jeff Goldblum. It was his first film performance. The second episode, not quite his first film performance, but it was very early on before he was famous, there was, in a bit part, Lawrence Fishburne. And in the third part, there was Alex Winter, who went on to play Bill in the Bill and Ted movies. So it was a series of films. The first three each had a particular co-star who was not quite famous yet, but soon would be. So do you have any idea, Stephen, what that would be? Don't say if you do, but do you have any idea?
No. I can think of some early Fishburne movies, but pretty much hate Jeff Goldblum, so I'm not any help there.
All right, well, we'll figure out what the answer is toward the end of the show.
All right. So one thing we wanted to talk about today is sort of a trend that seems to be becoming increasingly common in the movies. Just this summer, I'm sure everyone who's listening saw Pirates of the Caribbean 2, because I think everyone in the world saw it twice with the amount of money it made. But, of course, you know that movie ends on a cliffhanger, hopefully you know it. And it was filmed at the same time as the third movie, so we're going to get that next year, and will be the conclusion to the cliffhanger. But, you know, this is something that we started seeing more and more recently, I think, which is interesting because this is a pretty new phenomenon. Now, cliffhangers in film sort of have their start going back to the old serials of the 20s and the 30s, perhaps maybe a little into the 40s. But those were not feature films. They were usually shorter. And you know, you'd go out to the pictures every week or whatever, and you'd see the next installment of a serial that would sort of this long continuing story. And you know, some of these serials are 20, 40 parts long. They went on for quite a while, and they were in a way more like the precursors to serialized television, which is also becoming popular again today. But once feature films really became dominant, and we sort of got rid of those, you know, newsreels and double features
cartoons.
And stuff, cartoons, yeah. Sort of with the advent of television, a lot of that stuff just no longer made sense to show in the movie theaters. We didn't see a lot of cliffhangers in movies, largely because movies were not franchises up until really the late 70s. You know, you made a movie and that was it. Maybe you'd make a sequel, but probably not. You know, there are some series of films you can think of, like, I don't know, the Thin Man series, or even perhaps the James Bond series starting in the 60s, but all those movies are self-contained. You don't have to have seen one to really understand what's going on
and
in the other.
Moreover, there's a literary precedent of the fact that they are series.
Right, but they're not at all serialized. So you can
right.
They weren't necessarily created from whole cloth. Now, I think probably the big thing that changed all of this was Star Wars, because you know Star Wars comes out in 1977 and makes more money than pretty much anything ever had before. It's still one of the top grossing films of all time. You know, despite the fact that most of its money was made in the 70s. And so it's a huge hit. And, you know, depending on who you believe and who you ask, maybe that was conceived as a trilogy or six parts or nine parts or whatever. But a few years later, in 1980, we get The Empire Strikes Back. And from this point in time, Lucas knows he's going to make more movies. It's guaranteed to have a franchise. And so The Empire Strikes Back ends on basically a cliffhanger, sort of sort of drawn from the old serials, because certainly Star Wars draws its influences from all over the place, but definitely those old sort of swashbuckling adventure serials and movies that Lucas watched as a kid were a big influence. And so, of course, it famously ends with Han Solo being frozen in carbonite and shipped off to Jabba the Hutt. Luke finds out that Vader is his father, and the bad guys kind of win. And so we know, obviously, that the bad guys aren't gonna win in the end, but we're being set up for another movie. And, of course, in fact, when Star Wars was re-released in the theaters before Empire Strikes Back, Lucas added in that Episode 4 part to the very opening crawl of Star Wars, sort of showing, yeah, this is part of a continuing series. And what I think is interesting is you start to see some more of this stuff in the 1980s. Back to the Future is a great example. And the first Back to the Future was sort of released with that little bit of a cliffhanger ending. I don't think the original theatrical release had a to-be-continued part.
No, it wasn't. I remember.
When it made a bunch of money. But clearly it's set up for a sequel with Doc Brown showing up again. No, Marty, we got to go back to the future. I mean,
do you think that was really set up that way, or was it added on? Because it felt to me like one of those endings where, oh no, it's all starting over again, the end. You know, that, and there's no intention to go beyond that.
Well, I think certainly by that point, Back to the Future is what, 1985? Yeah. I think by that point in time, we had started to see franchises,
But you also saw things like Nightmare on Elm Street, which is I think the year before, and the ending of that is, oh no, he's really still alive. Whether that's setting up for a sequel or not, I don't know. I mean, the sequels don't continue from that point, so maybe that was just a fashionable ending, is just to not end it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, but you got to figure that when they're making Back to the Future, they're hoping it's going to be a big hit. The blockbusters are in full swing. That's what everyone's trying to do. And it is fashionable to make franchises. You've got the Star Wars movies. You've got, the Jaws franchise, strangely, was actually a franchise for a while. You've got, at this point in time, I think the first two Indiana Jones movies were out by the time Back to the Future was out. Interestingly, though, side note, it's interesting to me that the Indiana Jones movies, the second movie, is not a cliffhanger at all. All three of those movies are self-contained, because those really derive from the serials. But I definitely Stewart could have ended the second one on a cliffhanger. It would have made sense, but all three of those are self-contained and probably the better for it. But yeah, so you get Back to the Future sequels, and what's interesting about those is parts 2 and 3 were filmed at the same time and released pretty close to one another.
Yeah, that was one of the first times that was done, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it probably is the first time. I can't think of any other time, at least with I guess you can think of, say, the Superman movies, where 1 and 2 were sort of filmed. They filmed parts of 2 at the same time they filmed 1.
Right, and the 3 Musketeers and the 4 Musketeers, the Richard Lester duology from the 70s.
Right, same producers, right? Both those films, the Superman and the 3 Musketeers.
Actually, that's true, yes.
Because that was the model for the Superman movies, was the success of the 3 Musketeers and the 4 Musketeers. Film them both at the same time, you save money, and you get 2 movies. It's great. But, Superman and Superman 2 aren't exactly, I don't classify Superman as a cliffhanger. I think all three of those movies are
I think you're right. Probably The Empire Strikes Back was the first real prominent cliffhanger.
And
that's not long after sequels started becoming a fashion anyway, because, I think Jaws 2, as far as I can tell, that was the first movie to be 2.
Right.
The first thing, it wasn't originally conceived as a series, and so, hey, the first one made a ton of money, let's make another one and tack on the number 2.
Right, and geez, unfortunately.
And so only a couple of years later, we get The Empire Strikes Back, which is kind of a part 2, but with the cliffhanger ending in there, too. So both these things sort of came up around the same time.
And it's also interesting, I think Star Wars provides a model. You do a trilogy, that's how it works. If your first movie is a big success, and you can milk out sequels, probably plan to do a trilogy. Certainly, there's the rumor always that Lucas intended originally to do more movies, but after Empire didn't make as much money as Star Wars, he decided only to just sort of wrap it all up with Return of the Jedi, and probably went back and revisited them in the prequels. But then I think definitely just lately we started seeing a lot more of this, of the trilogies being filmed sort of as trilogies. You get something similar, I think, to Back to the Future with the Matrix movies. Matrix in 1999 comes out, and it ends not really on a cliffhanger, but not really with a ton of resolution either. It definitely left room for a sequel, but the Matrix stands alone by itself just fine. And when the Wachowskis make a ton of money with that, they get permission to go ahead and film parts 2 and 3, Reloaded and Revolutions, together. And Reloaded, of course, ends on a total cliffhanger that makes pretty much no sense. There's this, everyone who's seen it remembers that long conversation Keanu Reeves has with the architect that is completely and totally confusing. And I remember spending that summer just really excited for Revolutions because it's going to explain everything. And I liked Reloaded quite a bit, and then I saw Revolutions and just hated it. And and then I actually stopped liking Reloaded. I no longer like Reloaded because all the questions that I expected to be answered pretty much weren't answered in any satisfactory manner in my mind anyway. So I think that's
isn't even creative as a blockbuster either. It's just you know, we come back from the highway sequence on Reloaded where it's pretty spectacular visually, and then we just get endless fighting underground hand to hand. Interesting at all.
It pretty much just looks like a MechWarrior video game, really.
But so hopefully structurally.
Well, I think that's one of the dangers of this is that if you end on a cliffhanger, your third movie has to really and truly deliver. I mean.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people would agree that Return of the Jedi is weaker than Empire, but it's still a really good movie. So
yeah.
you don't really let down by that. You know, some of it's kind of silly, but it's still, you know, it's a really good film.
Well, hopefully the same thing will happen to Pirates of the Caribbean, and it won't go the Matrix route. Either way, yeah.
I think that's
you'd
one
think
of the.
You think if you were filming them at the same time, you'd maintain the same level of quality?
You would think, but
not what happens apparently. At least it's not reliable.
And I think. One other thing we should probably mention is the way that the Lord of the Rings movies were made, where they were basically kind of all just filmed together and then slowly edited and had all the post-production work done over a couple of years. But those were, obviously they have the literary source material. But I think what's interesting about that is actually the Two Towers film ends on less of a cliffhanger than the Two Towers novel.
Yeah.
Because I'm not entirely certain why Jackson decided to do that. I think he felt that he wanted to make Return of the King more of a full film with that opening. With Frodo and Shelob the spider?
Oh, actually, the spider doesn't wind up until after the halfway mark on Return of the King.
Right, that's right. They really drag that out of it.
In the books, it's in the Two Towers. So I think it's just when they decided what they wanted to film, they realized that the pacing was just all wrong. Unless you were to do it as Tolkien did and write a full story from Frodo and Sam's perspective and then go back in time a whole big jump and not interleave those stories at all.
Right, and I think cinematically it probably makes sense to interleave them. That works better in film than I think it does in books.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and I think this seems to be a trend. I don't think it was happening much at all before Back to the Future, that's filming a couple movies at once and releasing them.
No, and even Back to the Future was sort of an oddball because it hadn't been really done much in the 90s.
Right, and so I think certainly with The Matrix and the huge, huge success of Lord of the Rings and a huge success of Pirates of the Caribbean 2, I mean, partially it will depend on how Pirates 3 does, but I suspect that we'll start seeing more of this, and it may even be that we start seeing, say, a movie being filmed with a sequel before the first one is released. You know, so far, all the big ones have been parts 2 and 3 done at the same time. I wouldn't be surprised to see more studios doing maybe 1 and 2 at the same time because you can save costs if you have something that you know is going to be a blockbuster.
But you have to know it.
And that's tough
to do.
It's kind
of surprising that they're willing to take those risks. What occurred to me about this is that there's a parallel with books. Fantasy series, basically if you write fantasy novels, you're committed to a series. I don't know why. They never do a single volume anymore.
Right.
But with a new author...
Well, but I think because of partially Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
I mean, everything in fantasy novels just rip off Tolkien.
And if you're going to have to build a world from ground up, you've got to do more work anyway to get really, you know...
Sure.
Why would you do all that and then have a little leftover for story and then you're done? It doesn't make any sense. But the way it works, if you're a new author, lots of times the first novel you publish has to be self-contained. Just in case it doesn't take off. And then if it does, then you throw on sequels and publishers are okay with having cliffhangers at the end of it. And it occurred to me that that's sort of the structure we see with Back to the Future, with Pirates of the Caribbean, with The Matrix. You get one, and if it takes off, then you're allowed at that point to commit to more than just the next movie.
And the first installments in all of those series were left hooks. They weren't open-ended, but they definitely left hooks, left plot threads open for a sequel.
Yeah.
Though not so much in Pirates of the Caribbean, I think. Well, obviously, the studio did not think that movie was going to be a success at all.
No.
So it was definitely more self-contained. Parts 2 sort of starts as though Part 1 had been on a cliffhanger. I was surprised with how strange the opening of Part 2 is in that series. But yeah, I think it's something we'll probably see more of, and especially as Hollywood mines more fantasy series after the success of Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter, I think we'll definitely see more of this kind of stuff happening. So today we're going to do a top six list about the top six romantic movies that are not sappy at all. And, you know, a lot of people do top five lists, but we do top six because six is one more than five, so it's one higher, isn't it?
It's one more.
One.
When you need that one more on the top list.
Exactly.
You got it.
So yeah, the goal here is to pick movies that have romances in them, maybe are romantic themselves, but have no sappy, you know, swelling of the orchestral music as the two lovers meet and that kind of nonsense that I just hate because I'm dead inside. So so my number six on the list is Shaun of the Dead, which is the only rom-zom-com that I'm aware of, which creators have actually described it not as a zombie movie, but as a romantic comedy with zombies in it. And I think that's a pretty good description of the movie. If you haven't seen it, it's about a guy who's sort of learning to cope with taking his relationship to the next level. At the same time, he's trying to survive a London that's become infested with zombies overnight. And it's a really great movie and a pretty decent love story with some good zombie-eating people scenes.
I think The Corpse Bride would be another one to go in that category.
So what's your number six?
My number six is actually, I could have named just about any screwball comedy because I think that's the definition of screwball comedy. It's a romantic comedy without sappiness.
Right.
My favorite one is Bringing Up Baby, but I listed It Happened One Night because that's my favorite one that
that's
seems
good.
To center more on the romance. And it stars Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert, and they're just too busy irritating each other to be sappy, pretty much. I mean, the romance comes from how flustered and in denial they are about the fact that they like each other.
I restricted myself to only one screwball, too. I'll add that a little bit later, but I think definitely virtually any screwball comedy would work for this. So,
how about number five?
So number five, I've picked another recent movie, Lost in Translation, with Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson. I think it's a great movie. It's a romance, but it's so distant. Just it's about two people who are sort of emotionally distant from themselves and from one another, who sort of meet in this strange foreign land and both feeling disconnected and have a sort of romance, but it's not a normal romance. If you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. I think one of the things that makes it work is that it doesn't ever get sappy. There's no big payoff, and the very ending ends with just Bill Murray whispering something in Scarlett Johansson's ear, and I think everyone who's seen it remembers that, and it just hits all the right notes.
Yeah, the thing about that one is it doesn't feel like even a romance, really. It feels like a couple strangers who are just kind of meeting each other and getting to know each other, and you don't even really realize it until the end in that whispering scene. It's so emotional, and it just kind of comes out of nowhere. You realize, wow, look at how this movie has built up some understanding and empathy with these characters.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a good point, is that it's not so much about a romantic romance as it's about two people who find each other in a time where they both really need one another.
Yeah.
And I think that's key to its success.
Well, my number five is a little different than that. It's Seven Brides for Seven Brothers.
Mm.
It's a rousing musical comedy about a mountain man who travels into a frontier town to find a woman to marry, spies a pretty one, proposes marriage, and I love the response. It's, well, I'd have to finish my chores. So they get married, and he takes her off to the mountains, only to discover that he's living with six brothers, none of whom are civilized, and basically what she's there for is to cook and clean. Not really that sappy. Not very sentimental. And actually, it gets worse than that, because what the six brothers wind up doing is going back into the town and kidnapping wives for themselves. But it's more good-natured than it sounds, and ultimately the women have a civilizing influence on the men, and it's a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
But not sappy.
Not at all. It doesn't sound like it. Okay, so the last of my recent movies is my fourth pick, which is one of my favorite romantic comedies ever, High Fidelity. And I know you don't necessarily like this one as much as I do, but...
But I like it.
You like it. And it's, in fact, where we've completely stolen the entire top five idea from. But it's basically about John Cusack, who's recently broken up with his most recent girlfriend, and he sort of spends most of the movie recounting his past romantic failings and trying to figure out why it is exactly that they failed. And mixed into it is some sort of thinking about pop music and how it plays. And there's a great line about the very, very first line of the movie is whether pop music came first or misery came first. Is he sad because he listens to sad songs, or does he listen to sad songs because he's sad? And it's a really interesting movie. I think there's possibly one bit that I think you could classify as sappy right at the end, but Jack Black singing Let's Get It On, I think, kind of diffuses any real sappiness. It's a pretty great moment.
Yeah, and although we did take the top five idea from this, I'd like to note that we have improved upon it.
By going one higher.
Just to remind again, it is one better.
That's right.
Yeah. My number four is a conventional pick, perhaps. It's Annie Hall. probably Woody Allen's most respected film. It's up in the air as whether they think it's the best or not. But, see, I don't think Woody Allen could write a sappy scene if he tried, frankly. I mean, he could write anything, but he can't do that. He's just too cynical. He's too plagued by all these existential questions of life, the universe, and everything. But it is a romantic film, and it's funny. It's intelligent, too, about a lot of the kinks that couples hit in their relationships that a lot of movies just never, ever touch upon.
Hmm.
And it's nice to see that.
And I think that constant questioning and neuroticness is sort of a common thread throughout most of these movies. That seems to be one of the keys to avoiding sappiness, is they have characters constantly questioning everything.
They're too intelligent to be happy with just gazing in each other's eyes.
Exactly. So speaking of being too intelligent to be happy with that kind of nonsense, my next pick is My Fair Lady, one of the most romantic movies in which the two leads never so much as even hug. I mean, the big romantic scene at the end is the female lead throwing a shoe at the male lead, Audrey Hepburn, of course, and Rex Harrison. In particular, Harrison's performance is just fantastic throughout the entire film. It sort of gets classified as a romance all the time, though I'm not 100% certain it is. Whether or not the two characters really like each other that much is slightly debatable, but I think it does work because both characters are so independent of one another, and they sort of develop a very strange relationship, one of these stranger relationships in the history of film, I think.
Yeah, actually, you picked my number one. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit more when I get up there. But it is interesting. You never even, they certainly never kiss. They never say, I love you to each other. They're never even nice to each other, really. I mean, the closing line of the film is, Eliza, where the devil are my slippers?
Right.
And that's the great confession of all the feelings that have been brewing all along. My number three is Adam's Rib, and actually I guess this could be called a screwball comedy as well, so I picked two, but it feels a little different, and it tackles more social issues. It's kind of a battle of the sexes thing. Basically, the idea is that these two lawyers who are married to each other, they're played by Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, which I think is pretty much the best double billing of all time.
Mm.
And they start out already married, so it's sort of an unusual romantic comedy. Usually it starts with people meeting and then falling in love. But they're already married, they're happy, and then they decide to take opposite sides of the same case and wind up hitting some rocky times. But the whole thing becomes a sort of battle of the sexes. That case involves some questions of social equalities, stuff like that. But it's hilarious, and it's interesting to see an intelligent couple kind of working out their problems in a pretty much intelligent way. There's no falling back on the storytelling cliches that audiences have been conditioned to recognize as plot points, whether or not they make any sense at all.
Well, I think definitely the casting there is the key to that movie's success, especially
yeah.
one of the later scenes in the film after they've sort of broken up, and Tracy goes for this little scheme to try and get Hepburn back by pretending to perhaps be sadder than he actually is. I think that is sort of a great way of twisting the conventions of normal romance.
Sure, yeah.
So my number two pick is actually kind of similar to Lost in Translation. It's David Lean's Brief Encounter, a great film sort of about a woman who's considering having an affair, and she meets this man. It's made in 1945, right after World War II. I think it sort of is interesting in that it's not just a romance, very, 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 very subdued romance at that, but it sort of taps into, I think, this general feeling of uncertainty that perhaps a lot of people in the Western world felt after that war. Where do we go from here? And I think it's interesting that it has that sort of undercurrent running through it, based on Noel Coward's play, just a fantastic, fantastic screenplay and incredibly well-drawn characters. And it's interesting because it perfectly captures just characters of a specific place and time.
Yeah, what's interesting to me about that one, this is one of my favorite films from that time. What's interesting is that it takes a subject that pretty much you couldn't cover because of the Hays Code and comes up with some really sophisticated observations about that. How do you find yourself in a situation where you're happily married, but you find yourself attracted to a stranger? It cuts a lot deeper than I think a lot of movies today do that.
Right.
My number two is Amelie, the French film by Jean-Pierre Jeunet. And it's not even really a romance at first. It's a pretty unique film. I'm sure we're going to be talking about this in more detail in later episodes. But it's a vibrant, really colorful trip through a romanticized Paris seen through the eyes of a woman who is on this very strange quest. It's pretty much, I think, to amuse herself, but to do it by secretly helping out other people in the most creative ways she can possibly imagine. It's a little while before the film becomes a romance at all, but it does become one toward the end. And when it does, it's pretty joyously sweet without really feeling sickly sweet. And for a movie so boisterous, the climactic moment is one of the most mesmerizing of its kind, very still and silent, and I think that's the scene that sticks with me, really.
Interesting. I like how you say that it's joyous without being sappy. I think it's a pretty good description. I think maybe it walks an edge. It almost becomes sappy. I give that to you 100%, but definitely a great film, and not at all, you're right, not at all a traditional romance. So my number one movie is screwball comedy, my favorite screwball comedy, and it's The Lady Eve, directed and written by Preston Sturges, starring Barbara Stanwyck at her absolute sexiest and Henry Fonda. I think, like we mentioned, we could have picked any number of screwball comedies for this list because they were almost always about romances without ever being particularly romantic, and I think The Lady Eve is a great example of this. It's basically broken down into two sections, one in which Barbara Stanwyck is trying to trick Henry Fonda's character into falling in love with her so she can scam some money off of him. And then after he does fall in love with her, he finds out that she's scamming him and, you know, tears it off with her. But during this time, she has fallen in love with him. So later in the film, she's got to pretend to be someone else to win him back. And it's just a wonderful movie that is constantly cynical, which is pretty much a recurring theme through Sturges' work, with just some absolutely wonderful sight gags and pratfalls and also just lightning fast, razor sharp dialogue the whole way through, and never ever a moment of sappiness.
Yeah, it's funny when you study this time period, this genre, Preston Sturges and Frank Capra get lumped together, I think. Mm. And I don't know what could be more wrong. There's nothing, nothing cynical about anything Frank Capra ever did. He was always face value. Anyway. My number one, as we mentioned earlier, was My Fair Lady, and one song in particular is a highlight, I think, where Rex Harrison sings a song, I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face. Hmm. The lyrics are written by Alan J. Lerner, and when he wrote this lyrics, his goal was to write a love song that didn't have the word love in it, and it doesn't. It's not there, but it is a love song, and it doesn't have any of the cliches that get thrown into songs like this. He's just a bachelor. He's a confirmed bachelor, and he's trying to reconcile the loop that he's been thrown by meeting this woman. And I don't know that he ever really gets there, but he's trying to do it. He's trying to figure what all this is about. And I can't think of another scene in a film that does that, gets into that particular mindset.
As you mentioned, it's not that I've grown to love her. It's that I've just become used to her.
Yeah.
I'm accustomed to her.
Well, I think that you can debate it, but I think that might be love, and he just doesn't really get it.
No, I think that's definitely the point, is that he can't admit to himself that it is love, and
yeah. That's
how he kind of reconciles. Well, I'm not in love with her. I'm just used to having her around. It's odd. The Harrison character is just so not interested in changing anything in his life that I think he can't quite deal with that. One thing I think is interesting about that movie is that both characters seem to absolutely doing their best to not fall in love, not just with one another, but with anyone. Most romantic stories maybe have, you know, the subplot where one of the leads is engaged to someone else or falling in love with someone else, but no. In fact, in this movie, the Audrey Hepburn character, right, she quite emphatically rejects the advances of another suitor.
Right. And he's the only romantic character in the story.
Right, and he's
and
made
he's
to
just pretty
fool.
Much laughed out of the whole thing, you know. And then he just sort of disappears without a resolution to his character because he's just been made very much irrelevant.
So, okay, those are our, let's just run over it real quick. My top six in reverse order: Shaun of the Dead, Lost in Translation, High Fidelity, My Fair Lady, Brief Encounter, and The Lady Eve.
And my top six, starting with number six, was Sleepless in Seattle. Oh, no, actually not. That's another list. That's next week's list.
That's the sappiest movies that aren't actually all that good.
All right. Number six, It Happened One Night. Number five, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Number four, Annie Hall. Number three, Adam's Rib. And number two, to complete the title starting with A, trifecta, Amelie. And then number one, My Fair Lady.
So next up, we're going to talk about some upcoming movies on DVD, upcoming or just recently released films that we think are worth checking out. And I think you got something you want to talk about first, Sam?
Yeah, on October 10th, what gets released is a classic Wallace Beery film. It is not a wrestling picture. It's one of the best film adaptations of Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. Actually, my favorite was made in the 90s with Charlton Heston, but this one is definitive. made in 1934, and it's being released as part of the Motion Picture Masterpieces Collection, which also contains definitive adaptations of David Copperfield, Marie Antoinette, A Tale of Two Cities, and Pride and Prejudice, all released in the early 30s, spilling into 1940, and they're all very good. But I like this one. Jackie Cooper plays Jim Hawkins, and fun fact about Jackie Cooper, on one end of his career, he became famous as a member of the Little Rascals, and on the other end, he played Perry White in the four Superman movies with Christopher Reeve. Now, that's a career that goes places.
Unfortunately, it also included going to Superman IV, The Quest for Peace.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, that was one step too many, maybe two steps too many. Anyway, he plays Jim Hawkins, and he sets sail with Wallace Beery's Long John Silver in search of treasure. Okay. Long John Silver is one of the great villains in literary history, and Beery plays him with relish, alternately kind and cruel, just as Stevenson wrote the character. Now that pirates are suddenly popular again, it's a good time as any to revisit this classic.
I actually haven't seen it. I'll have to check it out, because I do love the story. It's a great, I remember reading it as a kid, a great book, and I've been adapted a lot. And, you know, it's probably better than other parts of the Caribbean movie, because I don't actually really like those movies that much. Okay, so one of the movies I'm looking forward to is a re-release, The Maltese Falcon 3-disc set, which is coming out on October 3rd as part of a Humphrey Bogart collection. Warner has done a couple of these, and so doing another collection, but you'll be able to get this 3-disc Maltese Falcon by itself. And The Maltese Falcon is one of those movies that really helped establish Bogart in the early 40s as a major leading actor. He had sort of been a supporting guy playing gangsters and that kind of stuff in the 30s. And then along with The Maltese Falcon and Casablanca in the early 40s, Bogart really sort of got the Bogart persona down. And The Maltese Falcon is also interesting because it's one of the early films noir, the sort of dark, grimy movies from especially the 40s and the 50s, that featured crime and femme fatales and just really a lot of fun. It's also one of the sort of, I think, archetypical private detective movies, and it actually makes a good companion with another good Warner release, which is actually already out, called The Big Sleep. Interesting companion. But it's nice because the current release on DVD of The Maltese Falcon is not so hot. The picture quality is kind of weak, and I don't think there's any real extras on it. So this is a 3-disc set. It's going to be restored. And if you've seen any of the other Warner re-releases, like the Casablanca restoration or their Citizen Kane restoration of some of these early 40s films, they're just gorgeous. And I'm really looking forward to this. There's going to be some cool extras, some retrospectives. And, yeah, it's a great movie. If you're not a Bogart fan, this will help make you one. And if you are a Bogart fan, this is something you'll absolutely want to pick up.
Absolutely. You know, that was director John Huston's first film. How many other directors come out like that?
I don't know. Orson Welles?
Well, yeah, he had a little film in there that was pretty good, his debut.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, definitely one of the great directorial debuts out there.
Yeah. Less well-known, on October 24th, there's a little film called The Last Voyage that will be released on DVD for the first time. It's a suspense movie about an ocean liner going down and the attempts of one man, played by Robert Stack from Unsolved Mysteries, to save his family amidst all the chaos. Does it sound familiar, Stephen?
Could it be similar to, the Poseidon Adventure?
Perhaps. It most closely resembles that, but, you know, pretty much that's the recipe for any disaster movie ever made, and the genre was very popular in the 70s. But this one was a bit ahead of its time. It was made in 1960, over 10 years before the genre's landmarks, The Towering Inferno and The Poseidon Adventure. And consequently, it feels a little fresher, a little less mechanical, and it actually is able to tap into some intimate emotions there. I haven't seen it in quite a while, actually, so maybe I'm misremembering it, and I actually will think it's distinct, but when I saw it, I was pretty impressed.
Now, interesting, if it's before all the disaster movies, does it have all these disaster movie cliches?
No, it's actually just about this one man and his family, and I guess his family is pretty much out of the picture, pretty much, because they're trapped somewhere, and so it's pretty much just him trying to figure out a way to get them out.
Interesting.
And that's it. It's not a whole collection of cardboard characters.
Is there no stripper with a heart of gold?
There's not.
Huh. I don't know if I can handle that. So speaking of large collections of characters, one of the ones I'm looking forward to coming out is a movie from this year, Robert Altman's Prairie Home Companion, tentatively scheduled for October 10th. This is, I think, a movie that wasn't a huge box office success, but I predict it will really find an audience on DVD. Altman's sort of probably best known for his work in the 70s, movies like Nashville and MASH with big casts and long running times. Prairie Home Companion has a pretty big cast. It's based on Garrison Keillor's long running radio show, and it was actually, the script was written by Garrison Keillor and stars Garrison Keillor. But the movie is strange. It's a fictionalized account of the last episode of this radio show, in which some of the people from the radio show play themselves, and other characters from the radio show are played by actors. It's all very strange. It sort of blends reality and fiction, but obviously the entire thing is fictional. But it's a lot of fun, some really great music, a fantastic soundtrack, and just sort of funny and a little sad and kind of bittersweet. But I think it was a little too strange, perhaps, to really be a big hit in the movie theaters. And it's a pretty intimate movie, which I think is sort of where Altman has been going lately, more toward those sort of intimate, smaller stories with even still lots of cast and this normal overlapping dialogue.
So tell me this. In a movie based on a radio show that was most popular in the heartland of America, why was it not released in the heartland of America?
Because there are no art house theaters in the heartland of America. I don't know why.
That's really too bad. It could have been quite popular there in the theaters.
Except, you know, I really just don't think it's not the sort of movie that you'd want to go out and experience in a theater necessarily. I think it'll actually play better on a smaller screen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, my last DVD pick here also comes out on October 24th. It is a goldmine for lovers of classic musicals. It's the Astaire and Rogers Ultimate Collector's Edition, containing all 10 of the films Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers made together between 1933 and 1949. With one exception, Roberta, I didn't like that one, but the other nine are fantastic. They're feel-good movies back before feel-good kind of became a synonym for saccharin and schmaltz. They're breezy, whimsical, fun, and funny, and it goes without saying that the dancing is just terrific. Swing Time is probably the most respected, but my favorite was, actually I have two. One is Top Hat, the first one that was written specifically for them. It features, among other highlights, the iconic cheek-to-cheek number. Mm. And I also have a soft spot for The Gate of Orsay, which is mentioned less often as one of their best ones, but it's hilarious. It's really funny, and it has an overproduced, and I mean that as a compliment, an overproduced climactic musical sequence that just goes on and on. It's if you're into that stuff, it's very interesting to look at. If not, maybe you'll be dozing off during that part. Whatever. It's got all the glitz and glamour you could ever ask for, and then some. These movies are so full of little pleasures, and I could take way too much time to talk about them all, but I do have to mention recurring performances by a couple of funny guys, Edward Everett Horton and Eric Bloor. You may not know the names, but they specialized at the time in playing flustered and stuffy supporting characters, respectively. You know, Stephen, it's kind of frustrating because way back in this time, Hollywood really knew how to handle good supporting characters, comic characters in particular. And now what happens, if you get a guy like Jack Black in High Fidelity, he's just fantastic, and so what happens is they move him up to the lead. And now he's playing the lead, and he may or may not be as effective there.
Yeah,
it's
I don't...
kind of too bad.
You know, though I did like him in King Kong quite a bit, in Jackson's remake of King Kong. I thought that was a fantastic
but
part for
different
him.
Different kind of a performance than what his signature...
Yeah, he's not. I don't think, you know, I sat through all of Nacho Libre, unfortunately, and just having to deal with Jack Black as a leading man is, I think, completely wrong.
Yeah.
So my last DVD release I'm looking forward to is another October 3rd, along with Maltese Falcon. It's another movie from earlier this year that I think had a pretty good response, but didn't really play too big. It was Thank You for Smoking, directed by Jason Reitman, the son of director Ivan Reitman, who directed Ghostbusters and some other movies that weren't all that funny, but... Thank You for Smoking is a really, really smart, really cynical, satirical comedy about a guy who works sort of as the PR man, the public face of Big Tobacco. And it's cynical the whole way through, which is just delightful. The characters don't have, you know, any big learning or discovery moments where they just change everything. And even though the main character's son plays a big role in the movie, even that relationship never gets sappy. And it's a really sort of satirical take on the way that in so much of today's communications that what you know, how you say is more important than what you say, and it pretty much takes no prisoners. It doesn't make the main character into either a saint or a monster. He's just sort of a realistic guy who is, as he puts it, trying to pay his mortgage, which he calls the yuppie Nuremberg defense for all manners of evil. And it's just a really fun movie that I think will play. Again, I think it'll probably find a good audience on DVD. It's not really a sort of a mass appeal movie, but if you like your comedies kind of bitter and with a dark edge, I think you'll really enjoy it.
Okay, so to recap the films we just mentioned.
On October 3rd, I've got the re-release of The Maltese Falcon, as well as Thank You for Smoking. And October 10th, the release of Prairie Home Companion.
And October 10th, Treasure Island, the definitive version. On October 24th, The Last Voyage and the Astaire and Rogers Ultimate Collector's Edition.
It's great. I'll be really looking forward to Astaire and Rogers because I've not actually seen many of their movies at all.
Yeah, good stuff. So do you remember that trivia question from earlier in the show?
I remember that there was a trivia question.
Okay. Well, the trivia question was to identify a film series in which the first episode featured in a very small role before he was famous, Jeff Goldblum. The second episode had Lawrence Fishburne, and the third had Alex Winter, who went on to play Bill in the Bill and Ted movies. So do you have a guess as to what this would be, Stephen?
No, I'm completely
stumped. You probably
guessed
the time period.
It's got to be the mid-80s or so, early to mid-80s. But
well, it went into the 80s. It started in the 70s. It was a series that is not remarkable in any other way other than this trivia question. It was called Death Wish.
Oh, wow.
Starring Charles Bronson. All three of those actors played miscellaneous hoodlums of some kind. Actually, Jeff Goldblum is billed as Freak Number One.
How could I forget that performance?
No, it was one to remember. So, yeah, not movies worth bothering with. The first one was okay, but, yeah.
Certainly iconic movies, though, in terms of, especially the first one, of really, you know, Bronson's persona.
Yeah, but that was pretty much a ripoff of Dirty Harry in the first place.
True enough.
That's about all we got for you this time, folks, but be sure and check out our website, allmovietalk.com. It's easy to remember, the name of the show, allmovietalk.com. New episodes come out every Tuesday, but the website is updated all the time, so be sure to check back frequently during the week for new stuff.
And also check out rinkworks.com. It's rinkworks.com. There's a bunch of movie-related things there, such as movie reviews and a film lover's checklist and a whole bunch more, so check that out. In the weeks to come on this podcast, we'll be talking about things like James Bond and the Coen brothers and Spider-Man and all kinds of great things like that. And also remember that starting next week, the audio quality will be substantially improved from what you heard this week. At any rate, next week on the show, we'll be talking about a great bad movie, and we'll also be talking a bit about the history of black and white and color cinematography in the movies, and an all-new top six list that's all about the bad guys. So tune in Tuesday.
Cut.